We're now talking posh. Well, we're pretending to talk posh. The Dictionary of Posh has been written by Hugh Kellett, who joins us now. Morning, Hugh.
Morning.
I'm not really qualified to talk posh, I don't think. I don't think northern people are allowed to be posh. I was born in Scotland, so are we allowed to be posh?
Everyone's allowed to be posh now.
Actually, people who were born in Edinburgh tend to be a little more posh than us poor Glaswegians. We were never regarded as posh.
Well, my mother was Glaswegian. And I went to school in Edinburgh, funny enough.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. So we're all part of the big family.
We are. Now, you studied languages at Oxford. It's obviously something that you're fascinated in, and you worked in advertising agencies most of your life. Well, I guess you had to be clever with words.
Yes. I've always been interested in language, how it moves, how it changes.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're happy with the changes. Other times the changes are that are more difficult to handle, but nevertheless it changes, so got to live with that. And I've written this book, I suppose, as a joke, really.
Yeah.
To be a funny book about what I perceive to be a lost language, or at least a language that was on the moribund, so I put it that way.
Yeah.
So there's a little attempt to amuse people by reviving it somewhat.
Well, I've talked about this quite a lot. As a broadcaster, I do detect a distinct change in broadcast journalists, for example, in particular on the BBC or on ITV or whatever, who have, and there's nothing wrong with it, who have tended to adopt more regional accents as time goes on. And they used to be very much the Queen's English on the BBC particularly.
Very much so. I think what's going on with language generally in English is there's a standardization, particularly in the south of England, where the language has become very identifiable. So regions per se are less, seem to be, me anyhow, to be less important the closer you are to London. But equally at the same time, and it may be partly a function of the BBC moving to Manchester,
sure,
that the regional reporting accents are very much encouraged, and I think that's good as well. That produces, I think, a more level playing field in many ways, and it's good to hear regional accents.
Well, I started radio back in the heady old days of 1975, so a long time ago, and it was a commercial radio station that I was working at then, one of the first commercial radio stations, and we had in our studio a phone number for the BBC pronunciation department at Broadcasting House. And if any words came up that we weren't sure how to pronounce, somebody would tell us what the correct pronunciation of that would be in the Queen's English. Isn't that bizarre?
Yes, that is indeed bizarre.
Imagine being that person just sitting there all day, bored senseless, waiting for some Muppet to call up and go, how'd you say this then?
I think a parallel to that would probably be in the world of acting. So I suppose if you looked at accents in films, and I'm quite interested in that, accents in films in the 50s, let's say,
yeah,
or at any time prior to the sort of Beatles revolution, this sort of thing, is that if you were an actor, you spoke in a particular way, you delivered lines in a particular way. They tended to be upmarket accents, to be frank,
yeah,
in the same way as the BBC would have encouraged received pronunciation. But after the 60s, of course, the acting profession, in a slightly similar to way as you're suggesting with the way BBC handles its regional journalism these days, the idea of actors being from different backgrounds became,
yeah,
very popular. Therefore, people like Michael Caine and Tom Courtney came from very non-traditional acting backgrounds in many ways, and certainly with non-traditional accents.
Very true, and I've mentioned this on the show before. It's something that winds me up a little bit, because when people are actors, I assume that they're able to act, and surely part of the skill of acting is to adapt your accent, which is why we get so many Brits doing American accents and vice versa in movies. But there are a couple, David Tennant, the Doctor Who guy, and the worst offender is James Nesbitt, who do every single character in exactly the same accent, to the point where James Nesbitt once did a Roman, I think he was Julius Caesar, you know, he's like, "Et tu, Brute, how's it going there, wee man?" And it's just, I find that ridiculous.
Yes, indeed. And it's not just accent. I think some actors really only really act themselves.
They do. Danny Dyer, there's one. Danny Dyer is just being himself, isn't he?
Danny Dyer is just being himself. Well, I always felt Oliver Reed was almost always himself.
Yes.
And I think Harrison Ford, to an extent, tends to play very, very similar roles, as does Bill Nighy.
Yes, true. So
these are people who, I mean, I obviously enjoy watching them, but versatility is probably not a strong point.
And then you got Hugh Laurie, who was exactly the opposite, who took American accents to America and convinced them all he was American.
Yeah, brilliant, yes.
Absolutely brilliant.
I think Hugh Grant, actually, talking about another Hugh, is, I don't know whether you saw the thing he did on Jeremy Thorpe.
Yes.
But that was, you know, well out of character, and good on him.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a bit off topic, but it's interesting nonetheless. Is it the Queen's English that started all this? Is it our current Queen, Queen Elizabeth, that invented that phrase, the Queen's English, or has it evolved through her, or did we all speak posh before that?
Well, that's a good question. I think it jumps between the Queen's English and the King's English, depending on who's on the throne. But I think the Queen's English is really the one that I'm sort of joking with on this. I mean, as it happens, it's fitted in quite nicely with the fact that the Crown new series has just started, but it's something that does, I think, I mean, it is a joke book, this, but there are one or two vaguely interesting observations. One of which is the way that the and syllable is pronounced by very posh people.
Yes.
Tends to be pronounced as end.
Yes, true.
So, for instance, you might say, take your hens off me.
Yes, yes.
Which in my book is spelled H-E-N-S. Just to explain slightly about this book, it's called The Dictionary of Posh. And what I discovered over a period of time was a sort of hidden language within English, which I've called posh, because it's only spoken by a sort of dying number of people, really. But the game in the book is that I found that 700 words of English that mean something completely different in standard English versus posh English.
Right.
So it's not just a book about accents. It's actually a book about the written word.
Indeed.
That is pronounced identically in standard English versus posh English. But in posh English, it means something completely different. And just before I sort of pick up on that a bit, what I was going to say is that it is possible, in my opinion, that the reason that hens, so hands, is pronounced hens in posh English, might be a throwback to the Hanoverian kings. So when the Germans, when the German line, the Hanoverians, took over the monarchy, George the First, George the Second, etc., most of them, I believe, didn't speak a great deal of English.
Of course.
And when they did learn to speak English, they tended to pronounce words like hand in a rather Germanic way, which Germans still pronounce to this day.
Yes.
And I think that has something that maybe linguists or would look at as a serious point. And it's slightly similar to the way the Spanish, to bring it into your domain, pronounce and lisp on a word like cerveza.
Yes.
Because that is not a standardized national Spanish characteristic necessarily. It's just that they, at one stage, were copying the lisp of one of their kings.
Yeah.
So the fawning courtiers developed this pronunciation of the Z and to extent C in Spanish. So I think that's a sort of
vaguely
interesting and possibly serious point.
So if Jonathan Ross had been King of England at some point, things could have been very different.
Indeed so.
Love that. That's a great thought.
Yeah.
Some of the ones you've written down in there are just brilliant. And as you say, they're written in a certain way. And we assume one thing, but of course the posh would assume another. One of my favourites is W-A-N-E, Wayne, as in the waning of the moon, which of course is not that at all. It's fermented grape juice, better known as wine.
Is.
Yeah.
It is.
A glass of Wayne.
A glass of wheat.
That's magnificent.
Or preferably a glass of dry wheat wean.
Oh, that's just wonderful. And I also like Sprites, S-P-R-I-T-E-S, which of course is sprouts, very appropriate for the Christmas period coming up.
Very appropriate. I'd actually, in case you asked my favourites, I was going to say Sprites.
Were you?
Was one.
Okay.
The other thing about this book that I was interested in is that I didn't want to just write a dictionary, even if it is a joke dictionary. So you can just pick up this book and read it as you can open a page and have a laugh. But in fact, there's a story that runs through the whole book, and it features an imaginary family.
Yes, indeed.
Who live in a castle in the south of England.
No, I can't pronounce the name of them, which is why I didn't ask. So I'm sure
well,
I was going
to... That seems to be a general case, actually. So yeah. I'll help you on that. So they live in a castle called Hurting So Castle.
Right.
And there is a sort of joke in the name, because the story is of how this castle is falling down around their ears, really.
Yeah.
And the fellow that owns the castle is a fellow called Lord Pales Hurting So, and right. I'll leave you to work that one out. And he has a ferocious and rather nasty wife called Lady Pales Hurting So. And they have some children who are not exactly the brightest of the bunch.
Yeah.
And it's a story about how he gets into trouble, he gets sued for libel, and how he loses all his art collection, and his butler rips him off, and
great.
His tenant farm, and etc., etc. So within it, there's a, let's call it a story.
Yes.
And it runs all the way through. So if you start this book at the beginning, you get a full story, as well as learning how to talk posh.
Magnificent.
So it's like a teach yourself a language, if you like, with a... To help students of posh, you not only learn the word, but you learn how to use it in context, and you have this story to help you keep your mind on the job.
Love it. Do you think, and I'm not being poshist here, that when we hear a posh or a Queen's English accent, we automatically assume that the person who is behind that accent is intelligent, and vice versa?
I think there is a tendency for that to be the case.
Mm.
Well, a lot of things human beings do are
yes.
emotionally rather than logically
driven,
but I think it has been. I mean, it's the function of, as you say, the voices that have been, that we've heard. I mean, I'm 63 years of age, so as you were saying, the BBC has fed me from the time I was a child with received English.
Yeah.
One assumed that they... We're intelligent people. I think we've been confused in that over time.
Yeah.
And clearly, it's not just intelligence, it's status.
Yes.
And it's interesting with the current issue around Prince Andrew, which I'm sure you're following over there.
Has he done something then? Has he done something?
Once you start rocking the top of the pile,
mm-hmm.
they try and clamp down on that in a big way, because otherwise the whole superstructure starts falling in.
Well, funnily enough, it was watching that documentary that kind of nailed me to think, you know, I actually thought he would be incredibly intelligent and bright, but in fact came across as a bit dim.
Mm.
And there we are.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
I
must say I'm inclined to agree with that.
Of course, Harry Enfield had the famous character, didn't he? Tim Nice but Dim, which kind of sums it up, really, doesn't it?
I think the detached is a total different world, unfortunately. I think some of it is just dim, and some of it is just not being connected with
the
same thing.
Yeah, no, fair point. Well, one can only hope that your book is successful, and then we can say cheers to you, can't we?
Cheers, you can, yes.
We can say cheers and go off for a G&T with some ace.
With some ace.
Yep.
And I've written a couple of other ones. I like redness. So REDNESS, redness.
Yes.
That means being in a state of alert. is it in a state of permanent redness? That's another one I quite like, is that one talks sometimes of the posh accent being clipped.
Yep.
And I think what that comes down to is what I've called aristocratic stinginess.
Mm.
So, you know, why spend a long time pronouncing a word?
True.
When you can pronounce it quicker.
Yes.
So, for instance, J-E-M-M-Y,
yes.
Emmy.
Yes, yes.
Is what they would call Jeremy Paxman.
Of course.
They would say, morning, Jemmy.
Of course.
And that saves them a syllable, you see.
Well, that must be what it's all about.
It is.
Yeah, I love it. There's so many lovely examples in there. Yeah. We should all go back to our mentions and discuss it. Fantastic. The book is called The Dictionary of Posh. Hugh Kellett, really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Great.
Take care. Bye-bye.